Good morning. I'm Dr. Gay Carlson, president of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, with another of my Screenside Chats. As some of you know, Screenside Chats are meant to share timely clinical practice and other information from experts on key topics that are impacting us during this COVID pandemic. Reminiscent of Roosevelt's fireside chats during World War II and the Great Depression, I hope they'll be informative and comfortable and fill a niche not otherwise addressed by materials you have available to you. Today, our chats addresses a serious topic, that of suicidal behavior in children and adolescents. I'm really pleased to have the person who's done extraordinary work on this topic, Dr. David Brent. I'll make my summary of him brief, otherwise it'll take the whole chats. Dr. Brent is Academic Chief of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, Western Psychiatric Hospital, and holds an endowed chair in suicide studies at the medical school. He directs services for Teens at Risk, a state-funded program for suicide prevention, education of professionals, and treatment of at-risk youth and their families. He's a member of the National Academy of Medicine, which speaks volumes for his stature. He's been recognized for his research by many organizations, including the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, the American Psychiatric Association, and Brain and Behavior Foundation. His work is focused on risk factors for adolescent depression and suicidal behavior, and on the translation of those findings into clinical interventions. He's helped establish standards of care for assessment of treatment of depressed and suicidal kids, children, and adolescents. I'm going to open the topic with two things that come up in my practice. As some of you know, also, my presidential initiative is on emotion dysregulation in children and adolescents. And one of the things that I see when kids become emotionally dysregulated is they will say things like, I hate my life, I'm going to kill myself. And they do this in the context of having been thwarted at something or disappointed about something, something that has caused them to be upset. And so they will say this. When you talk to them afterwards, many times they'll say, I just say that in a fit of anger and frustration, but not all the time. And so I'm going to ask Dr. Brent what his thoughts are about what you do when a kid utters something like that in the heat of the moment.
Right, it's a great question, and it's a pleasure to be here. I think that what you want to do is avoid premature closure. It's really easy to dismiss the seriousness of suicidal ideation or a very low lethality suicide attempt as non-serious, before exploring what is actually going on. And I think you're better off labeling it as, you know, a suicidal threat that perhaps is of low lethality and intent, and then trying to understand what are the factors that led up to this person saying that and to what extent they actually intended that, you know, when they say those things. And of course, then there's the educational issue that is there something else you can say that, you know, will get let people know that you're upset without, you know, setting off all these alarms that maybe are going to cause more attention to you than you actually want.
If they do something, so on one hand, you can have the, I'm going to kill myself if you don't give me back my phone. Next level up is the child who scratches himself or herself with a bobby pin or pokes, you know, does something that is clearly on the face of it trivial. And again, I'm thinking about children who are then brought by the police to the emergency room, by which time the dust has settled. And the emergency room doctor is left with having to code an SSRS or something to that, you know, something like that to summarize what has happened with the child and how to intervene or how to understand it.
So I think it's the same principle that intent, first of all, intent and lethality in young kids is very modestly correlated. So a kid could actually have fairly high intent and engage in a low lethality suicide attempt. But, you know, in the circumstance you're describing, it's probably not that. It's probably low intent or just an act of frustration. But again, it's important to unpack what are the events that led up to it? What was the person's motivation? You know, what were they hoping to achieve? And what is their intent now? And with the goal to focus on the unlikely dysregulation that led to the event in the first place, to see if there's another way that's more constructive to express frustration with a situation.
I wasn't going to talk about this till the end, but maybe I'll talk about it now. And that's the impact of, or one of the impacts of media on suicidal behavior. When Joan Asarno, and you know Joan, and I did a little paper 30 years ago, it was, what is a child's understanding about suicide and suicidal behavior? Not child understanding of death, child's understanding of suicide and suicidal behavior. One of the questions we asked was, you know, what do you know about suicide? If somebody wanted to kill themselves, how would they do it? The answer to that question was they would stab themselves or shoot themselves. This was from the mouths of children. Adolescents said they'd overdose, which is, of course, what adolescents often do. Children don't usually shoot themselves or stab themselves unless there's a gun available. And at least 30 years ago, the suicide rates were quite low. And they're still low, but they've increased. And I'm wondering if any of that increase is due to the increased publicity that we've had about suicide in kids, or the increased availability of knowledge on the internet about how to kill yourself. So when we asked, when we looked at a similar question now 30 years later, what kids said was hang themselves. Okay, shooting and stabbing are not there on the list of things that kids would do if they wanted to kill themselves. Hang themselves was. And of course, that is how kids are killing themselves. And so I'm wondering if somehow or another, there are two things going on, that there's increased knowledge about that. And of course, you know better than anybody about the guidelines that we have for media about what you're supposed to, you know, put in the front page about suicide. But also you can look it up. You can look up online what you want to do to kill yourself, and you might not want to do it at that moment, but you then have a loaded gun in the back of your head that you can take out should you want to kill yourself in that moment of despair. What do you think about that?
I think that we know that, for example, imitation is a factor in suicidal behavior, although the majority of suicides in kids and adolescents don't occur in clusters. But it's much harder to discern that now because with social media, you don't need to look at geographic clusters.
Yeah, you don't know what a cluster is.
Exactly. And if you look, I don't know about in kids particularly, but if you look at the social networks of people who are suicidal, they're much tighter and much denser with other suicidal people than people who are non-suicidal. So that you could get the idea there's kind of this reverberation going on. And there's no doubt that, you know, you can get information like how to kill yourself from the internet. And I think this speaks to the fact that I think a lot of parents feel very helpless about their kids' access to social media. The fact of the matter is that access is a privilege. Parents have a responsibility to monitor it. There are, you know, software that can alert you if kids are doing, you know, searches that involve pornography or other kind of risky things. And you can also review it yourself as a parent. And one of the factors that moderates whatever deleterious effects of social media there are on mental health is the degree of parental monitoring. And so I think that the important thing is that you need to know what your kids are looking at, and have an open discussion with them about it. In addition, people are, you know, beginning to develop algorithms that, you know, detect them, that may alert parents and or, you know, push helpful information to people if they're doing searches that seem to indicate suicidal risk.
Well, that's useful to know. Do you think COVID has increased the rates of suicidal behavior in kids?
Well, to prepare for this, I did some research, and I think suicide, we don't know yet. The statistics tend to lag a year or two behind. But there is evidence of increased suicidal ideation in some surveys. And certainly there are many, many risk factors associated with this pandemic that would lead to an increased risk for kids' suicide attempts. You know, economic dislocation, bereavement, you know, sharing the same space and more family tension. There's definitely an increase in opiate overdoses. And we actually did a study that showed, not surprisingly, that in parents that misuse opiates, their kids have a higher rate of suicide attempts. And then there's the fact that kids may not be in school, are disconnected from their friends. So there's a lot of factors that could set people up for an increased risk for suicide. And one other thing is that if you look at the ER data, it looks actually like there's a lower presentation for suicide attempts now than there has been, which may suggest that people are not seeking care. So there may be more people out there who are at risk who aren't ending up getting any help.
Yeah, well, given if you look at our data, and I have looked at it in our emergency room at Stony Brook, obviously a lot of those kids are sent by the school. So it sounds like it's the same situation we have as far as abuse is concerned. We don't have the supervision of an adult that's different from a family member looking out for the well-being of the child. So that's a real issue. What do you think we can do? Here's a $64 question, right? Cure COVID. Are there any particular interventions that you would think about that we could be doing for kids that might be suicidal and at home, or that, you know, somebody's doing a telepsychiatry interview and they feel uncomfortable about the child and, you know, they ask, and no, I'm not depressed, things are fine, but you still get an uncomfortable feeling about the kid? What would you suggest?
Well, I would share that with the kid. I would talk with the parent. And, you know, if you still get, you know, no positive response, you may want to see them again, have contact more frequently, let the parent know, you know, what to look for. Maybe take some precautions like securing, you know, lethal agents, while, you know, you're trying to figure out what's going on. But that's an issue, you know, that, to me, that's an issue that's independent of COVID. And the fact of the matter is kids can dissemble just as easily in your office as they can, you know, by telehealth.
I don't know. I guess I'm an old poop as far as that's concerned. I feel like I can connect better with a kid in my office, that I can sort of get down and really look at them closely and engage with them. I can't do that as well.
I deal more with adolescents. It may not be as much of a factor.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I can say for the kids that they could just get up and leave the room, you know, and they can't do that in my office. Right. So I think that's one of the things that is more troubling. I mean, everybody's really caught up in how great telehealth has been in terms of getting us access to kids, but, you know, children and adolescents. But I do think that they have some limitations. And so, and I would say that's one of them.
So I think there are some other things that can be done. You know, we can certainly, you know, emphasize measurement-based care. I think it's important anyway, but I think getting some kind of self-report or, you know, baseline and ongoing data about how they're doing can give you, sometimes kids will answer something on a self-report questionnaire that they won't tell you face-to-face. And although this isn't ready for prime time, there are people that are working on, you know, computer analysis of facial expressions and voice quality that I think, because I don't think we're going to go back to full office ever. Mm-hmm. Because it's more convenient for people. They don't care that it's harder for us. Mm-hmm. And so I think that those tools may be helpful in terms of, you know, giving you some additional information about what's going on with people.
I think that would be really neat. You know, one of the things that I remember years ago, when I was treating adults as much as children, is I would notice when people, I would put somebody on an antidepressant. This is when I was living in Missouri, and so people would have to come a long way. So I did a lot of telephone stuff. And I noticed how often it was that even though the person told me that they were still depressed, I could tell in their voice that they were feeling better. Their voice sounded better.
Right.
And I said, you know, I don't throw in the towel yet. You sound better to me than you did the last couple of weeks. I think you may start feeling better in the next week or two. And it was amazing how often that was true. So right. I think the idea of the voice recognition is a very exciting frontier that maybe we'll be able to put on our computers, and we can have the little waves going down there going, that's a problem.
Right. And I think using, you know, passive cell phone data with kids that have phones may also be useful, because I think, you know, to your point, a lot of times people that are depressed, when they're coming out of depression, the last thing that changes is the way they feel. But often they'll, you know, start studying, they'll start doing activities maybe before they start feeling good about them. And so they'll say nothing has changed. And, you know, you're saying, well, you know, these things have changed. And how cool would it be to be able to show somebody, you know, like on a graph that it really is, you're moving around a lot more. Yeah. You're not agitated.
Yeah, we don't need that. So measurement-based care, and that's also a topic near and dear to my heart. What are your favorite measures to use?
Well, our clinic, we see both kids and adolescents, so we use the MFQ. One of the things that's, I like them to be free.
Free's good.
Yeah, well, there are very commonly used instruments that aren't. So the ASQ is a good measure of, you know, suicidal ideation and behavior. We use the SCARED for anxiety. There's a 5-item SCARED that's short. The longer one, you know, gives you a lot more information, but it's longer. We use a screen for bipolar, for mania. And we use the ARI for irritability. And we have a sleep measure, the Pittsburgh Sleep Quality Index, I think it is. But and we actually, send a link to the kid, you know, but right before the session. So we have those on an ongoing basis. And it's useful then you can look at things over time and share with the kid and the parent about what is going well, what isn't going well. You know, the rationale about why you want to make a recommended change in direction.
Is the link like a red cap type link, or how does that work?
Yeah, I think we used something called Qualtrics.
Qualtrics, okay.
Yeah,
but because I was going to say to you, I think getting measures to the people to do is a little bit more. I mean, usually when I see people in the office, when I'm getting information from the parent, I give the child a whole swath of rating scales to do, and then I see the child and go through the rating scales. That's a little bit harder to do online unless you have a link already set up, and not everybody does. You know, one of the treasures of things that you've written, and I've told you this before, is your Saving Holden Caulfield talk that you gave at the plenary at ACAP a couple of years ago, and that was published in the, and I'm going to give the reference so people know about it, in JCAP. It was January the first 2009 edition of JCAP, called Saving Holden Caulfield. That was not only moving, it was brilliant in terms of you really had some very specific suggestions. So why don't you, we've got about 5 to 8 minutes left. Let's talk about prevention. Spell it out.
So I don't think we really, I don't think we really invest enough in prevention as a country. And there's a website in Washington State. I think it's the Washington State Public Policy Institute. And they do cost-benefit analyses on, you know, all kinds of interventions. And so, for example, there's an intervention called the Good Behavior Game, which in their estimate costs about $158 a kid to deliver. And it basically it trains teachers in how to socialize kids to behaving in a classroom. And it involves, you know, taking turns and you know, controlling your aggression and you know, being part of a group and those sort of things. And they have been able to demonstrate lasting changes 20 and 30 years later, half the rate of suicidal ideation and attempt, but also better employment, lower rates of incarceration. And it's like, why isn't this in every classroom? So
it's not rocket science. And I've seen the videos. I sort of grew up with, I remember, you know, listening to Shep Kellum's, you know, original talks about the Good Behavior Game. And when you watch it in action, it's really sort of good behavior modification. It's reinforcing the kids that are behaving and ignoring the kids that aren't behaving. And they have a way of doing it, a well-trained teacher doing it, that is a pleasure to watch.
And I think that the other advantage of these prevention, you know, cost-effective prevention interventions is you don't have to screen anybody. You know, you deliver it in a natural setting, so you don't have to worry about access to care, about cost. And you know, if our politics were aligned, you know, that somehow we would reap the financial benefits of, you know, this type of investment. So that's, you know, one example. There's prevention of maltreatment, which, you know, yes, we have treatments once maltreatment occurs, but you know that there's a lot of lasting effects. It's one of those things that's much, much better to prevent than to try and deal with after the fact. And it's a significant risk factor. The other advantage of these preventive interventions is they're not just focused on suicide. They tend to prevent upstream a lot of bad outcomes. So they're very efficient if chosen correctly. And probably the most intelligent approach to this is an intervention developed by David Hawkins at University of Washington called Communities That Care, in which they engage in a strategic planning process with the thought leaders in a given community. They administer some questionnaires to schools so that they identify the risk and protective factors in the given community, interpret it, and then help them select evidence-based prevention programs that they think would work in their community. They randomized 24 communities to either get that or whatever they were going to do. And there were lasting effects in follow-ups 9 years later. So I really think I think we need to be better informed about these things so we can advocate for them. And I think they're just, We can't afford not to do this.
Are there other school? I mean, I remember doing a review on this and looking at gatekeeper approaches versus whether or not kids are the best people to kind of keep an eye on their peers versus having PTA meetings with their parents, et cetera. What are your thoughts on some of those interventions?
Well, I think the best done study is the study, the Cellier study that came out of Europe, and they randomized 11,000 students from 168 schools to either gatekeeper training, screening and referral, a curriculum that taught kids how to identify mental health issues in themselves and others and how to deal with it, and then a control condition. And the only it was only the curriculum that pulled away from the control group and had half the rate of serious suicidal ideation and suicide attempts 12 months later. And there's a similar intervention called SOS, Signs of Suicide, that also has similar results. So I think the curricula that are aimed at kids, giving them more tools to identify issues in themselves and other how to respond to others is probably the most efficient intervention.
Yeah, I've often thought, you know, it might not have made as good a drama, but if 13 Reasons Why had an appropriate response to the protagonist with her suicidal feelings, I wonder how many lives we could have saved.
It's a good point. I think there is, media can be a powerful force for good and not just for bad.
Talk to me about access to lethal means.
Well, in this country, it's really a waste of time to ask people to remove guns from their home, for the most part. But most people will agree to keep those firearms in a more secure manner, particularly if you can give them a trigger lock, a gun safe, something like that. And, you know, the evidence is that basically the more accessible a gun is, the more likely it's the more likely that somebody in that home will suffer either an accident or a homicide or suicide. But there, you know, there's also evidence, for example, pesticides in Asia, that if you either restrict access or keep them in secure containers, that you can reduce suicide. There are studies that look at bridge, you know, barriers for bridges. So I think that trying to make it the environment safe makes a lot of sense, particularly for kids who are very impulsive, as that's how we began our discussion. And if they have access to lethal means, what to do about hanging, I don't know.
That one is really troubling, because I used to think of hanging as, well, you know, by the time you find a rafter and a rope and, you know, do all of that, I mean, you're not suicidal anymore. But, you know, kids use strings from their curtain rods and they pull on them and, you know, it's not that difficult to do. And mm-hmm. I think that's what's troubling about it. I think it's like, if you read about it, you can follow the directions. There are also, I had a discussion with David Schaffer once about, you know, you talk about the fact that accidents are often veiled suicide attempts. I also think that sometimes if you could have, and please don't think I'm being glib about this, but if you could do a seance with people who ended up dead from suicide and say to them, is this really what you had in mind? That there would be a number of them that said, no, this is not what I wanted.
I have a great example of that. I had a patient that jumped about 150 feet and somehow miraculously survived. And I said to him, you know, that's a long way down. Like, what were you thinking about? And he said, oh, expletive.
Well, maybe that note is a good one to end, because it's a very serious subject and one that my hat is off to you for all of the work that you've done. I know, because of the help you gave me in my school district 25 years ago, what the personal cost is when you know people who've killed themselves, and you know what it does to the community when that happens. And so you have a heart of gold and the resolve of steel, and you have the respect of everybody in child and adolescent psychiatry. So I thank you very much for being part of our Screenside Chats today.
Okay, it's a pleasure for me to have 30 minutes of conversation with you.
Oh, thank you very much. And to our audience, thank you for attending another of our Screenside Chats. And I heard a cute quote from one of our members saying, think positive and stay negative, stay safe. Take care. Bye-bye.
Right. Bye-bye.
Thank you all very much for tuning in. This is Gay Carlson for ACAP's Screenside Chats.